Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 961. Watergate and the Assassination of JFK, Part 1. This is being recorded on June 13th of the year 2017. There is much discussion of Watergate in the air, what with Russiagate, as they are saying, certainly weakening and perhaps imperiling the administration of Donald Trump, as is sadly characteristic of the way our media and our historical/academic establishments work. They didn't get Watergate right the first time, and comparisons between, quote, Russiagate, unquote, and Watergate, actually they do have a similarity that is not getting discussed in our media. We haven't got time to go into quote, Russiagate, unquote. Suffice it to say that the core of that, quote, scandal, unquote, is the high-profile hacks that I have talked about before the record 917, 923, 924, 940, 943, 958, 959, and in 960. In For the Record 925 and 926, I compared the high-profile hacks with the painting of Oswald Red. Suffice it to say, as by the way, we are now on June 13th of 2017, we are 4 days away from the 45th anniversary of the Watergate break-in on June 17th of 1972. That was a little less than 5 months before the election of Richard Nixon. And ultimately, of course, it turned him out of office. There was much celebration. What people failed to note was that sitting right behind him was Gerald Ford, who had been a member of the Warren Commission. As a young man, Gerald Ford had been a member of America First, a Third Reich intelligence-financed American, quote, isolationist, read fascist organization. Gerald Ford had the Halloween Massacre, as it has been called, and in 1975, he basically laid the groundwork for much of what was to come. The Ford interregnum between Nixon's resignation and Ford pardoned him, and the ascension of Jimmy Carter led to the, okay, that might have been 74. I think it was 75. But it laid the groundwork for much of what came later. Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz all got their start at this point in time. Watergate was not the triumph of a free press and democracy over tyranny or totalitarianism. Nixon, suffice it to say, was removed by a coup d'etat because it wasn't far enough to the right. And Nixon was an SOB of the very first magnitude. The Watergate team, as it came to be known, the burglars, were all, quote, ex-unquote CIA. James McCord, a very high-ranking CIA official, was the fellow who put a piece of scotch tape over the door latch on the door at the Watergate Hotel. Instead of having the tape running parallel with the edge of the door, he had it perpendicular with the vertical plane of the door so that Frank Wills, a security guard, discovered it. Then after Wills noticed that and removed it. McCord then placed yet another piece of scotch tape, again perpendicular to the vertical plane of the door rather than along the edge of the door, so it would keep the latch from closing. And once again, it was plainly visible. When Frank Wills discovered that the tape had been replaced, he realized that there were people inside of the Watergate complex, called the police, and the burglars were arrested. It was James McCord who sent a letter to John Sirica, saying that he would burn every tree in the forest if he were prosecuted. Suffice it to say that that was a coup d'etat. We are seeing something similar with, quote, Russiagate, unquote. Not only was the point man for Trump's business dealings with Russia, Felix Sater, a Russian immigrant, professional criminal, and CIA operative, but the quote, Russiagate, unquote, special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, is a longtime fixer, having covered up effectively the intelligence, drug trafficking, and terrorist connections to the BCCI scandal that in turn inextricably linked with the professional career of George Walker Bush. Mueller was head of the FBI, and I noted in For the Record 310 in July of 2001 that, in my opinion, he had been put in to cover up the links between the Bush family and the Bin Laden family. When those came to the fore after the Operation Green Quest raids of March 20th of 2002, once again, Mueller covered it up. I will put links in the description for this show. Suffice it to say that we do not have time to go into it here. Lying at the core of the coup d'etat that led to the removal of Richard Nixon, again, a first-rate SOB who deserved what he got, just like Donald Trump is a first-rate SOB, even more deserving, perhaps, than Nixon. However, we had another, perhaps even bigger SOB, Gerald Ford, waiting behind Nixon, and Mike Pence is an even bigger SOB than Donald Trump. Swapping Donald Trump out for Mike Pence is like swapping Frankenstein's monster for Count Dracula. Lying at the core of Watergate was the assassination of President Kennedy. And in our next three programs, we're going to review that history largely for the benefit of younger listeners. We are going to go back to November 15th of 1983. This is excerpted from The Guns of November, Part 3. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my very charming and capable former co-host, Nip Tuck.
Okay, I'm going to read a small segment here. This article originally appeared in Ramparts magazine, which we've mentioned before. However, it is the edition that we are reading from is also out of the anthology we've been using tonight, The Assassinations, Dallas and Beyond. It appeared in Ramparts in 1973. This is also by Peter Dale Scott, and this is on his section in which he is talking about the Kennedy assassination and its relation to some rather interesting characters. And I'm going to read as follows. The Secret Service in Dallas intercepted a letter to Oswald postmarked Havana, November 28, 1963. That's 3 days, 6 days after the Kennedy assassination, and signed by Pedro Charles, Pedro, P-E-D-R-O, Charles. The letter indicated that, quote, Oswald had been paid by Charles to carry out an unidentified mission, which involved accurate shooting, unquote. Meanwhile, the FBI possessed a letter from Havana to Robert Kennedy, quote, written by one Mario del Rosario Molina, which alleged that Lee Harvey Oswald assassinated President Kennedy at the direction of Pedro Charles, a Cuban agent. When they say Cuban in this case, the letters alleged that Lee Harvey Oswald was acting on behalf of the Castro government. That's the Cuban agent that they're referring to Pedro Charles as supposedly being. Anyway, continuing on with the Warren Commission's assessment. According to the writer, Oswald met with Pedro Charles in Miami, Florida several months ago, in other words, in early 1963, and was paid $7,000 by Charles. That's quoted directly from the Warren Commission testimonies. By now, and this is going back to Scott's article, by now this story seems absurd. The elaborate FBI chronology of Oswald's movements gave no indication that he ever visited Miami. Okay, and let me mention one other thing, too, real briefly. This is right out of the Warren Commission, although it's not mentioned in this particular article, is that the FBI also discovered that those two letters, one of them alleging that a letter to Oswald signed by Pedro Charles, blah, 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 saying Oswald was going to have to do some accurate shooting, and the one to Robert Kennedy revealing this connection, were both written on the same typewriter. So you can see what kind of story this was. It was an obviously planted story. Now, going on with Mr. Scott's article. But at the time the letters arrived, a reporter in the Miami area named James Buchanan was publishing stories attributed to Frank Sturgis, alias Frank Fiorini. Frank Sturgis, of course, Watergate burglar, Watergate involvement, ex-CIA, ex-Bay of Pigs veteran.
Also, by the way, in charge of managing the mob's casinos during the mafia heyday in pre-Castro Cuba.
Indeed. All right. James Buchanan, this Miami reporter, was publishing stories attributed to Frank Sturgis that Oswald had been in Miami and also had been in contact with Castro's Cuban intelligence. Later reports from James Buchanan's brother, Jerry, placed Oswald in Miami in March of 1963. These concatenating pieces of misinformation from Miami and Havana suggest, in retrospect, a conspiracy to mislead. And again, the knowledge that both of the letters were written on the same typewriter also certainly leads to that possible conspiracy. The stories today are much less important than Buchanan's sources for them, all of whom came from two Miami-based anti-Castro groups. The first group, the DRE, the Student Revolutionary Directorate, was Cuban. And we're going to get back to that in a second when I finish the article. That's the DRE. We'll talk about that. The first group, the DRE, was Cuban, and the CIA used it to infiltrate Cuba in connection with the Bay of Pigs. The DRE was named in Oswald's notebook, since Oswald had been in contact with them in New Orleans and perhaps in Dallas. The second American group, which included both James Buchanan and his brother Jerry, was the International Anti-Communist Brigade. It was a small band of mercenaries headed by a named source of Buchanan's articles, Frank Sturgis, alias Fiorini, the future burglar of Watergate. Sturgis, like the DRE, had been employed by the CIA in connection with the Bay of Pigs invasion. But after the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962, Kennedy had begun to crack down on anti-Castro raids launched from the continental United States. Jerry Buchanan had been arrested by the British in the Bahamas in April 1963 on board a boat formerly used in CIA missions and now being used without presidential authorization for an intended raid against a Soviet tanker. In September, the federal government had issued, quote, strong warnings to six Americans for their anti-Castro activities, including Frank Fiorini, or Frank Sturgis, same name, same person, and Alexander Rourke, the owner of Jerry Buchanan's boat. As for James Buchanan, the brigade's secretary and propaganda director, Sturgis allegedly broke with him in December 1963 because of his, quote, excessive attacks on the FBI and the CIA, quote, even going so far as to describe former President John F. Kennedy as a communist. Similar anti-Kennedy sentiments were allegedly expressed by Carlos Bringier, Oswald's contact with the DRE in New Orleans, and a right-winger who later headed up the Cuban Americans for Nixon Agnew. Another witness told the Warren Commission that Bringier, because, quote, the United States didn't help to overthrow Castro, hates the United States almost as much as he hates Russia, unquote. Because these sentiments were so widely held among Cuban exiles, many students of the Dallas assassination have theorized that a group of anti-Castro terrorists, Cuban and or American, may have killed Kennedy in revenge for having been abandoned by the CIA in 1963. Okay, now a couple of quick points to make. Carlos Bringier, who is the member of the DRE that they mentioned in connection with floating this phony story about Oswald and a supposed Castro intelligence agent named Pedro Charles. Well, those of you who listened to last week's show heard...
Two weeks ago.
My apologies. Heard Lee Harvey Oswald. You're right. You heard Lee Harvey Oswald on a radio program with Carlos Bringier on the program attempting to steer Lee Harvey Oswald into saying that he agreed with Fidel Castro's characterization of John F. Kennedy as a thief and a ruffian. okay, and Bryn Geer, a violently anti-Castro Cuban right-winger, was on this program with Lee Harvey Oswald, where he made his announcement of Marxism that was aired all over the country on the night of the assassination. And again, Bryn Geer tried to steer Oswald into a position siding with Castro and calling Kennedy a thief and a ruffian. Now, go ahead.
A couple of points that, now remember that this organization, the DRE, why don't you handle a Spanish on that, Nip?
Yes, it's the Directorio Revolucionario Estudiantil.
Okay, now that is a CIA-sponsored organization. Bryn Geer is a member of that. And he is in this radio interview, which we aired a couple of weeks ago from radio station WDSU in New Orleans. And this was aired in August of 63 originally. And then, of course, everyone all over the country was able to hear Lee Harvey Oswald talk about what a communist he was the night of the assassination. Now, the person who was on there who helped arrange this, along with Jim Stuckey, the host, and, of course, Oswald was there, was a fellow by the name of Ed Butler. Now, Ed Butler was affiliated with an organization called the Information Council of the Americas, also a CIA-sponsored organization. So here we have a couple of people with documented CIA ties interviewing Lee Harvey Oswald, talking about what a Castro sympathizer he was. Now, keep in mind about Oswald that he was the sole member of the New Orleans chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. Now, this pro-Castro, pro-communist organization shared an address. Basically, it was one of two addresses from which you could get to the same second-store walk-up, which was shared by an office, which it masqueraded as a detective agency. In effect, it was a far right-wing paramilitary front, which we're going to talk about in just a second.
Involved in, among other things, shipping arms to Cuban anti-Castro activists, okay? So once again, to touch on the high points here, we have almost immediately after the assassination, we have a rather contrived and elaborate story being floated with letters coming from Havana, et cetera, suggesting that Lee Harvey Oswald was a Castro agent sent to kill Kennedy. And these stories are concocted, among others, by Frank Sturgis, who later turns up, who is a CIA Bay of Pigs veteran, et cetera, et cetera, later turns up as a Watergate burglar, and Carlos Bryn Geer, who set Oswald up on national radio as a Marxist and later shows up heading the Nixon Agnew, Cuban Americans for Nixon Agnew. And we all know that Watergate was in part directly connected to the Nixon Agnew reelection campaign of 1972. So we got a whole bunch of stuff tying in there. Now, we're going to go on to another person who plays a rather interesting role in this whole thing and who himself ties back to that self-same New Orleans office that Lee Harvey Oswald's Fair Play for Cuba Committee, a supposedly pro-Castro organization, shared with Guy Bannister's detective firm, which was a front for anti-Castro activity and right-wing shenanigans of all shapes and sorts.
And this group was fingered by Jim Garrison, and we're going to talk about that in a second. Now, the fellow you're going to hear about was one of three witnesses who Garrison tried to have extradited and was not able to have extradited. And probably best maybe to fill in some of the context so you understand who this guy is in connection with the JFK
assassination. And the Gordon Novell extradition attempt is such a screamer. Even though we mentioned it before, it should be mentioned again. It's so funny.
This is, again, the characteristic legal somersaulting which takes place in connection with the Kennedy assassination. Is one of the many, many strange aspects to this case. Now, basically, a fellow by the name of David Ferry and a number of other CIA-affiliated right-wingers were associated with a guy named Guy Bannister. And Guy Bannister had been head of the Chicago's FBI office, ran what masqueraded as a detective agency and, in effect, was a far right-wing paramilitary front in New Orleans. Bannister was a racist, published something called the Louisiana Intelligence Digest, maintaining that integration was part of a communist conspiracy. Now, his detective office shared a second floor, it was a second floor walk-up, and Bannister's detective agency had the address 531 Lafayette Place. Lee Harvey Oswald, the sole member of the New Orleans chapter of Fair Play for Cuba, had 544 Camp Street, but if you walk up each flight of stairs, you get to the same room, okay? Now, Garrison, basically, without going into all of his investigation, he sought to convict a man. He indicted a man named Clay Shaw for the assassination of President Kennedy, and he tried to have a number of different people extradited, either as co-conspirators or as witnesses. Now, one of the reasons that Garrison's case, one of the reasons it fell through, was the fact that three of the key people he sought to have extradited were not extradited, and the jury found that there had in fact been a conspiracy to kill President Kennedy, they could not find that Clay Shaw, beyond a reasonable shadow of doubt, that he had been involved in the conspiracy. They decided that they proved that there had been a conspiracy, could not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Clay Shaw had been involved. But basically, Garrison's case was deep-sixed by the lack of extradition of three witnesses. First of all, a guy named Sergio Arcacha Smith, another anti-Castro Cuban, Garrison filed an extradition request to Texas to have him extradited from Texas. Then Texas Governor John Connally refused to grant that extradition request, and he crops up in a number of different contexts, including Watergate. He was indicted in the milk scandal connected with Watergate. We'll talk about all that in the phone-in section if you like. Now, the second witness was a guy named Edgar Eugene Bradley. He was stopped by a Dallas policeman named Roger Craig, Oswald Double was stopped by a Dallas policeman named Roger Craig. An individual came up and identified himself incorrectly, as it turned out later, as a Secret Service agent, and this Oswald Double was then let go by Roger Craig. Now, the fellow who identified himself as a Secret Service agent was identified from photographs by Roger Craig as a guy named Edgar Eugene Bradley, a right-wing California... affiliated with Reverend Carl McIntyre, a right-wing evangelist who gained a lot of note in the 60s. Now, Edgar Eugene Bradley lived in California, so Garrison filed an extradition request to have Bradley extradited to New Orleans, and then Deputy State Attorney General Charles A. O'Brien, Deputy Attorney General for California, he reviewed the extradition request, recommended that it be granted. Now, then Governor Ronald Reagan turned this whole affair over to his legal counselor, Edwin Meese, who was not only a colonel in Army Intelligence, in the Army Reserve affiliated with intelligence, but also was not only Governor Reagan's legal advisor, he's now President Reagan's White House counselor. Okay, and Meese handled the day-to-day goings-on with regard to the Edgar Eugene Bradley affair. Reagan did not act upon the extradition request until after Richard Nixon had been elected president and then turned down the request without comment. Now, the third of the third of the people that Garrison tried to have extradited and was unable to do so was a guy named Gordon Novell, last name N-O-V-E-L. Now, Novell was affiliated with the same anti-Castro, CIA-sponsored right-wing milieu in New Orleans in the South that we've been talking about. Now, he also was affiliated with the Bannister's, quote, detective agency, unquote. And Novell had deposed to Garrison in connection with an arms theft case connected with Bay of Pigs that a whole bunch of munitions taken from the Schlumberger company, intended for use by Bay of Pigs brigade against Castro, had been stored overnight in Guy Bannister's detective agency. Again, this second floor walk-up with two addresses, one to right-wing Guy Bannister, one to alleged left-winger Lee Harvey Oswald. Now, Garrison wanted to question Gordon Novell in connection with the Kennedy case. Novell split for Ohio, and Garrison filed an extradition request to then-Governor of Ohio John Rhodes. Is it John Rhodes? I know there was the minority leader was John Rhodes from Arizona, and it was Governor Rhodes of Ohio.
I believe it's Governor John Rhodes.
Rhodes. Anyway, Governor Rhodes, first name we may be wrong on, but Governor Rhodes of Ohio, and I think it's John Rhodes. Basically, he agreed to extradite Gordon Novell on the condition that Jim Garrison would not question him about the assassination of President Kennedy. Now, this is absurd, of course, because that was the very thing that Garrison was attempting to have Novell extradited in order to question him in connection with. So the governor of Ohio says, yeah, we'll grant the extradition request if you don't question him about the thing you want to question him about. And so that's who this fellow Gordon Novell is now. Pick up on his connections to Watergate.
That's right. That slays me. No pun intended. Okay, this little section we're reading here is from a book called Coincidence or Conspiracy, produced by the Committee to Investigate Assassinations, under the direction of Bernard Finsterwald, Jr., coincidentally enough, James McCord's lawyer at a later point, and compiled by Michael Ewing. This particular book is published by Zebra Books, Kensington Publishing Corporation. It's copyright 1977. We're going to start out talking about Charles Colson, but Gordon Novell will crop up very quickly. Charles Colson, President Nixon's special counsel and widely hated hatchet man from 1969 to 1973, was the man who originally selected E. Howard Hunt to set up the secret White House plumbers. Colson, with a single exception of H.R. Haldeman, seems to have been involved in more of the horrors of the Nixon Rogues Gallery than any other aide. During his years with Nixon, Colson attained a well-deserved reputation as one of the meanest, most slippery, and dangerous men ever to serve in American government. Nixon himself had once remarked, quote, Colson would do anything. Colson had once been involved with one of Jim Garrison's former, quote, suspects in a mysterious plan to erase the Nixon Watergate tapes in March of 1974. This strange information first came to the surface in August of 1974, when Jack Anderson disclosed that Colson had met with New Orleans electronics specialist Gordon Novell in March 1974 and had begun developing plans for the magnetic erasure of various Nixon tapes. Novell, who had received national attention in 1967 as District Attorney Garrison's, quote, missing witness when he was under investigation for his reported contacts with both David Ferry and Clay Shaw. Novell and Colson discussed the use of an experimental degaussing machine, which could project a magnetic beam into the Nixon tapes and erase them without having to handle them in any way. Anderson reported that Colson had described some of the tapes as containing conversations that, quote, could cause the president's grief, and that Novell recalled that Colson had also spoken of using the erasing machine to obliterate some secret recordings maintained by the CIA as well. Following his discussion with Colson in March of 1974, Gordon Novell flew to Texas to see an associate and drew up a blueprint for the erasing plan, which he cryptically referred to as, quote, the El Paso matter, when he later sent the blueprint to Colson by hand courier in Washington. Colson claimed that the whole erasing idea was just, quote, a joke, and that he had discussed the plan only for, quote, a little bit of comic relief. Okay, well, without confusing you by trying to give you too much more on the Watergate thing itself, just bear that in mind. Here's Gordon Novell, a former Jim Garrison extradition request denied by John Rhodes unless they would agree not to talk to him about the very thing they wanted to extradite him for. Gordon Novell crops up in Watergate trying to help Charles Colson, allegedly trying to help Charles Colson erase the Watergate tapes. Colson, on the other hand, turns around and calls it, quote-unquote, a joke. Okay. Now, this next two little bits here real quickly. This is something we ran across just a couple of years ago with help from Mae Brussel, who found this for us, and we used it on One Step Beyond, and we're going to repeat it here. This is from Technology Illustrated magazine, and it's the April 1983 edition. Okay, and this first little bit is just a little introduction to an article, and it's written by, you know, somebody on the staff, and they're just introducing the article, and they say, last summer for spy tech, and this is meaning like summer of 82, so this is pretty recent. Last summer four spy tech luminaries gathered at a private 60-acre camp in Powder Springs, Georgia. Mitch Werbel, the host, known in military circles as, quote, the Thomas Edison of silenced weapons, Gordon Novell, a New Orleans entrepreneur and reputed offshore arms merchant, sometimes referred to as the Mad Bomber, Gordon Liddy, star of Watergate and his own autobiography, Will, and Lieutenant Colonel Alan Bell, U.S. Army, retired, one of the world's acknowledged experts in the field of electronic spycraft. Okay, now, that's just the intro that they use, mentioning Gordon Novell as being present with Liddy at Mitch Werbel's ranch, and Mitch Werbel's camp, actually, is what it is. And calling him and mentioning that he's sometimes known as the Mad Bomber. Now, interestingly enough here, in the Technology Illustrated for July of 1983, Mr. Novell takes pen in hand or typewriter in hand to write an article, to write a letter in himself. In the midst of his letter, where he is talking about different things, he says, quote, the only people, this is Gordon Novell himself, by the way, writing in response to that introduction in the article. He says, quote, the only people who have ever had the fortitudinal stupidity to call me, quote, the Mad Bomber are all now defendants in two ongoing federal civil suits totaling well over $2 billion in damages. This one-man war resulted mainly from my ultra-high technology counterintelligence role in Watergate to erase the White House tapes. Okay, so here's Charles Colson on one hand talking about his contact with this ex-Garrison extradition request as being comic relief and a joke and basically saying it didn't happen. Here's Gordon Novell turning around in a letter to Technology Illustrated basically bragging about his high-tech role in Watergate.
Okay, now the Watergate tapes themselves and some of the controversy surrounding them might be worth covering at this point for those of you who may be scratching your heads and wondering just what this is all about. It was revealed during the course of the public White House, public Watergate hearings by a fellow by the name of Alexander Butterfield that Nixon's White House had a taping system set up and that basically all conversations in the Oval Office had been taped. Now, these tapes were then requested by the special prosecutor set up by joint agreement between the President and Congress to prosecute any crimes connected with Watergate. Of course, these tapes became possible evidence and were subpoenaed as a result. Now, a number of the tapes turned up with very suspicious gaps. One in particular had a very famous 18-and-a-half-minute gap in the middle of it, which remains a source of controversy. So here we have Gordon Novell talking about erasing the Watergate tapes. Many of the tapes themselves have, to this day, unexplained gaps. And indeed, the gaps themselves have some interesting Kennedy-related connections. Nixon's secretary, a woman named Rosemary Woods, was one of the primary suspects in connection with the 18-and-a-half-minute gap. And facing possible prosecution, she retained a man named Charles Rhine, R-H-Y-N-E, who was a legal observer to the Warren Commission and also a close personal friend of Richard Nixon. A lot of other Watergate connections we're going to go into. The GOP counsel, the minority counsel, was a guy named Albert Jenner, and he had been a Warren Commission counsel. So the Kennedy connection, that there are many minor ones. We're going to go into some of the major ones here in just a second.
Okay, one of the other things that needs to be mentioned in context of the Nixon tapes is that one of the things that Richard Nixon at one point was, I believe, and I don't remember the exact person he was arguing with or he was talking to, but it was one of his aides, Richard Nixon, and this is in the transcripts once once this came out, and you can find it, I believe, in places, in a variety of places, but Richard Nixon said, literally, one of the reasons that the tapes should not be revealed because they were going to bring up this whole, and I quote Richard Nixon, this whole Bay of Pigs thing. Now, in and of itself, that is very interesting because, according to popular theory, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, embarrassing as it might have been for America, was all known. The Bay of Pigs invasion was started and it failed. Well, one has to ask a series of questions about why Richard Nixon would be so worried, and he was worried, as the conversation showed, about this whole Bay of Pigs thing. And we've talked in the past about his role in planning the Bay of Pigs, which was also pretty well known. But we've also mentioned two possibilities. One is the fact of the CIA scotching their own Bay of Pigs, and the other is the possibility that the scotching of the Bay of Pigs led in part to the assassination of John F. Kennedy.
Okay, and worth noting, too, that Nixon ran against Kennedy in 1960, and the Bay of Pigs was one of Kennedy's main embarrassments, and here's Nixon trying to cover the thing up. Talking about also about the tape gaps, too. At one point, Nixon, and in his reference to the whole Bay of Pigs thing, at one point Nixon was considering, in fact, asked former Warren Commission Chief Counsel J. Lee Rankin to go over the tapes to help edit out national security-related matter. Rankin declined, by the way. So, again, the same cast of characters crops up. Now, last week, when we were talking about the evidentiary aspects of the Kennedy case, we talked about something called the single bullet theory in a nutshell. And I mean in a nutshell, what this provides for is that a single bullet caused all seven non-fatal wounds in President Kennedy and Governor Connally. There were three shots. One blew Kennedy's head clean off, one missed completely, which leaves a third shot, and that one alone to account for seven non-fatal wounds. If more than one shot is required to cause those wounds, the whole Warren Commission thesis goes down the tubes. Now, one of the things we looked at last week was the fact that something called neutron activation analysis had been performed upon the bullet fragments found in the Kennedy limousine. Now, under that test, basically, the fragments are bombarded with neutrons. They give off a spectrum which reveals the exact molecular structure of the substance. And this is a tremendous breakthrough in regard to forensic science, because this enables determination to be made about bullets and ballistics that had previously never, had totally eluded would-be investigators. Now, as we saw last week, the neutron activation analysis performed on the bullet fragments disproved the single bullet theory, which was physically impossible in a number of respects, but some of the bullet fragments which were found in the car were proved not to have come from CE-399, and this totally disproves the single bullet thesis. Now, one of the main one of the most noteworthy authorities on the Kennedy assassination, one of the sort of main men of the research, so to speak, is a fellow by the name of Harold Weisberg, last name W-E-I-S-B-E-R-G. We referred to some of his work last week. Harold Weisberg is a former FBI agent who's authored a number of different books on the Kennedy assassination. His most famous series is called Whitewash, and there are four volumes, volumes 1 through 4. Also wrote an excellent but very rare book called Oswald in New Orleans. Now, in 1970, Harold Weisberg and his attorney, a man named Jim Lazar, filed a Freedom of Information Act suit to oblige the Department of Justice and FBI to release the results of the spectrographic analysis of the JFK bullet fragments.
Something, again, should be mentioned just to bring you back up to the present. We are now talking about the Richard Nixon presidency's Justice Department that they were applying to for permission to get this spectro evidence released.
Exactly. And this is 1970. Now, this is 7 years after supposedly Lee Harvey Oswald killed President Kennedy. Okay. Now, the interesting thing about this is that the Freedom of Information Act specifically forbade the withholding of all information, of any information, because of national security or because of national interest. That was not regarded as one of the reasons why a given federal department could withhold information from a Freedom of Information Act suit. Now, what we've looked at in the past, we're going to look at some of the amazing legal maneuvering that took place in connection with one or another aspect of the Kennedy assassination case. Now, it's worth noting here that, first of all, as everybody learned in high school, our government has three branches. There's the executive, the legislative, and the judicial. All right, Congress is legislative, president is executive, and the Supreme Court and courts are the judicial. Now, the Warren Commission was a presidential fact-finding commission. As such, it was part of the executive branch of the government. It was not part of the judicial branch. As a result, the Warren Commission had absolutely no legal status whatsoever. Keep this in mind, because some very, very strange things are going to occur. Now, when Jim Lazar, Harold Weisberg's attorney, filed a Freedom of Information Act suit, they received a number of different rebuffs from the Justice Department. Now, the only legal grounds upon which the Justice Department can withhold information from a Freedom of Information Act suit as if it pertains to an ongoing investigation and could in some way damage that or corrupt that. Now, of course, the official version with regard to the assassination of President Kennedy was that Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone nut, unaided, killed President Kennedy, and since he himself was then executed by the second lone nut, so to speak, Jack Ruby, all possible legal action in the case officially came to an end as of 11/24/63 with the death of Lee Harvey Oswald. So there was no ongoing legal action being pursued by the Justice Department, at least that we know of, and ongoing legal action is the only conceivable grounds that the Justice Department can use to withhold information from a Freedom of Information Act suit. Now, keep in mind that the FBI's spectrographic analyses were performed for the Warren Commission, which is not even part of the judicial branch of our government. It's part of the executive branch. Now, keep these things in mind, because we're going to see some very, very strange things occurring here. Now, I'm going to read you a couple of excerpts here from one of Harold Weisberg and Jim Lazar's books. It's called Whitewash, Volume 4. Okay? And the possible legal grounds for the Justice Department withholding evidence from the Freedom of Information Act suit is described here by Jim Lazar, writing in an appendix to Whitewash, Volume 4. There was only one conceivable legal justification which the Department of Justice could invoke, its old favorite, the exemption for, quote, investigatory files compiled for law enforcement purposes, unquote. But the purpose of the investigatory file exemption was to prevent premature discovery which, quote, could harm the government's case in court, unquote. Unless the government would admit to conspiracy, the only possible law enforcement action had expired on November 24, 1963, when Jack Ruby gunned down Lee Harvey Oswald, the government's only suspect. Moreover, the analyses had been done as part of an investigation the FBI made for the Warren Commission. Where the assassination was concerned, neither the FBI nor the Warren Commission had law enforcement powers. Indeed, FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover testified before the Warren Commission that his agency had no jurisdiction to investigate the crime. The Warren Commission did have authority to investigate the assassination, but not for the purpose of prosecuting law violators. Its purpose was to establish the truth and report it to the president. Now, in spite of the fact that it had no legal basis for resisting Lazar and Weisberg's suit, the government did so, and not only did they attempt to prevent disclosure of the spectrographic evidence, but they went through a number of very strange legal maneuvers in order to do this. First of all, when the case was to be heard, the government filed an affidavit by an FBI agent named Marion Williams, which was regarded as a key piece of evidence. Now, the affidavit was filed at the last possible minute. It was filed so late that it did not give Jim Lazar, Weisberg's counsel, time to respond to it, and it was a key piece of evidence. This is worth noting because the affidavit itself was dated 2.5 months before it was filed, so that obviously they could have allowed Jim Lazar, Weisberg's counsel, to go over this 2.5 months in advance. They held this up to the very last minute, and the judge allowed them to do that. Now, in Whitewash Volume 4, the significance of the affidavit, again, by an FBI agent named Marion Williams, W-I-L-L-I-M-S, is covered as follows. This from Whitewash Volume 4. The Williams affidavit was an absurd document. It contained at least one provably false statement, mischaracterized Weisberg's request for the results obtained from the spectrographic tests as a request for the release of raw data, unquote, and recited a catalog of speculative horrors which Williams said might ensue court-ordered release of the analyses. Quote, it could lead, for example, to exposure of confidential informants, the disclosure out of context of the names of suspected persons on whom criminal justice action is not yet complete, possible blackmail, and in general, do irreparable harm. And Jim Lazar goes on to comment here, the Williams affidavit was clearly preposterous. There is no way that releasing the spectrographic results could lead to the exposure of confidential informants or any of the other harms Williams imagined. Now, a hearing was set before the judge on this case. The government's attorney, a man named Robert Werdig, W-E-R-D-I-G, showed up very late for the hearing. The judge then announced that he was going to have to leave early because he had an appointment to keep. The judge's name, by the way, is John Sirica. Now, John Sirica is old Maximum John, the judge for the original Watergate case that in which the Watergate burglars were tried, and his steadfastness in pursuing that case is often credited with having, along with James McCord's letter, with having broken the Watergate case. So pay close attention to his actions here. Now, still later, the government's attorney, in arguing to prevent disclosure of the spectrographic evidence, argued basically that the Attorney General of the United States had determined that national interest would be harmed by the release. Now, remember that national security or national interest was specifically exempted by Congress as a reason for withholding evidence, so that has no merit here whatsoever. In addition, there's no indication that the Attorney General ever made any such finding. Now, perhaps one of the most amazing things connected with this legal maneuvering around the release of the spectro evidence concerns Robert Werdig's argument when pressed by Lazar to cite a reason why, cite what law was being enforced by the FBI performing the test for the Warren Commission, remember, part of the executive branch. The attorney says, well, it just has to be some law, quote, natural or human, unquote. Not much of a legal argument. Imagine if you're a student, if you did not hand in your term paper to your professor on time, and when asked why you did not, you said, well, it just has to be some reason, natural or human. Or imagine if you're at work and you're asked by your boss why you didn't do something, and you gave the excuse, there has to be some law, quote, natural or human, unquote. Well, you can anticipate the response. So this was the nature of the government's argument here, and the resolution of this particular case, and the government's statement that the Attorney General had determined that release would hurt the country, is covered by Jim Lazar as follows, again from Whitewash Volume 4. Talking about government attorney Werdig here, Robert Werdig. Werdig had another and dirtier trick up his sleeve, one which also helped divert attention from the spurious Williams affidavit. He told Judge Sirica that, quote, in this instance, the Attorney General of the United States has determined that it is not in the national interest to divulge these spectrographic analyses. Because Congress had expressly rejected national interest, unquote, as a grounds for withholding information, Werdig's assertion was at best irrelevant and irresponsible. I now believe that it was worse than that. I believe that no attorney general has ever made any such determination. No such determination has been produced. In a latter case, the government refused to answer an interrogatory I addressed to it about this, quote, determination, unquote. All of this also detracted from the failure of the Department of Justice to justify its legal position. For example, when pressed to say what law was being enforced by the FBI's investigation for the non-law enforcing Warren Commission, Werdig could do no better than to argue that there just had to be some law, quote, natural or human, unquote. At the conclusion of oral argument, Judge Sirica, ruling from the bench, granted the government's motion to dismiss. He delivered no opinion and made no findings of fact. So, apparently, Judge Sirica felt that some law, natural or human, was a good enough excuse for the executive branch of the government to be granted temporary law enforcement powers. However, it's worth noting that eventually the case was overturned on appeal, and it's the spectrographic evidence upon release confirmed what everybody already knew, which was that the single bullet theory was impossible.
That's right. As a matter of fact, we presented some of that spectrographic evidence and the FBI's response to it and the way they dealt with it in the second part of the program, or the second part of the series. Another comment that, of course, has to be made at this point is when we're talking about that particular Justice Department, I think it also has to be mentioned that the Attorney General at that time, who, whether he did or did not affirm that the national security would be jeopardized, who was in charge of that Justice Department, was, of course, John Mitchell, who I think in 1969, about a year before this happened, was quoted as saying, "This country is going so far to the right you won't recognize it." John Mitchell himself, the chief law enforcement officer of the entire country, who as Attorney General was responsible for, of course, the secret slush fund, bribing of officials, the setting in motion of a chain of events to literally intimidate and lie about other candidates and a variety of other just absolutely sickening, even on the surface, just sickening illegal activities. This was the Justice Department that was fighting to look for some law, natural or human, to deny the spectrographic evidence to Weisberg and Lazar.
By the way, that same Justice Department, Jim Garrison has taken a bad rap from popular American history as having been sort of a publicity seeker, and he was defamed as a result of having been indicted. Now, he was indicted for allegedly skimming profits from pinball machines. He was acquitted of this charge, and the witnesses against him were all basically mafiosi working for Carlos Marcello, who was capo mafioso for New Orleans, and also was one of the prime mafia suspects in the mafia angle of the assassination of President Kennedy. And this suit was brought, this was filed under Jim Garrison's Justice, or under John Mitchell's Justice Department, rather.
Indeed.
Detail I forgot to mention when talking about Judge Sirica was that he had campaigned for Richard Nixon in both of his successful presidential campaigns and had contributed money as well.
That's right. So, an interesting character who crops up again. Now what we're going to talk about, and somebody that we have mentioned from time to time on both One Step Beyond and Dave's show Hard Rain, is a gentleman by the name of Leon Jaworski, whose name has cropped up in several situations, not only Watergate, which we're going to talk about, and the Kennedy assassination, which we're going to talk about, but of course, more recently in the Koreagate scandal and other things of that ilk.
And in the very beginning of his career, he also was involved with the Nuremberg hearings. So Mr. Jaworski has been there many times when the legal worm has turned, historically speaking. Okay, now, an agreement by agreement, I really should say, between the presidency and Congress, between President Nixon and Congress, a special prosecutor was set up in order to basically investigate and prosecute any crimes performed in connection with the Watergate affair. Now, the initial person agreed upon by both Congress and Richard Nixon was a man named Archibald Cox. Now, Archibald Cox was President Kennedy's solicitor general, and in that capacity had been consulted by President Kennedy with regard to a number of different matters, including the possible arrest of right-winger General Edwin Walker for stirring up trouble when the University of Mississippi was being desegregated in 1962. Worth noting, because Edwin Walker crops up in connection with Lee Harvey Oswald and other people in connection with the investigation. If you'd like to know about that, we'll talk about that in the phone-in section of the program, because we've discussed it before and time marches on. Now, Archibald Cox was very doggedly pursuing the White House tapes, the transcripts of the tapes that we referred to in the portion of the program just concluded. Now, as I mentioned, a White House aide, Alexander Butterfield, had revealed the existence of the White House taping system, and that thereby all Nixon conversations, all conversations in the White House had been taped. Now, Archibald Cox was pursuing the release of some of these transcripts in order to investigate possible criminal wrongdoing in connection with the Watergate affair, and apparently was a little too diligent in his pursuit of these tapes. Nixon attempted to block release of the tapes by claiming executive privilege, and when Archibald Cox would not buy that, in what became known as the Saturday Night Massacre, Richard Nixon fired Archibald Cox and several Justice Department aides who refused to effect the firing of Archibald Cox, including his own attorney general, and basically Richard Nixon fired the congressionally appointed special prosecutor. Now, the man that Richard Nixon named as a successor to Archibald Cox was Leon Jaworski. He was approved by Congress. Now, Leon Jaworski had cropped up in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy. Basically, Jaworski was not only a special Warren Commission counsel, but he was also special counsel to something called the Texas Court of Inquiry. Now, what this was an abortive body set up by then-Texas Attorney General Wagner Carr, last name C-A-R-R, to investigate the assassination of President Kennedy for the state of Texas. That investigation never got very far, and Leon Jaworski was named as a special counsel to the Texas Court of Inquiry. And as a special counsel to the Warren Commission, he was in charge of investigating the allegations that Lee Harvey Oswald had been affiliated with either the FBI or the CIA. And picking a man like Leon Jaworski to investigate something like that is very interesting in light of his background.
Indeed, and we're going to read a brief section here again from a book that we just used a few moments ago, Whitewash, Volume 4, by Harold Weisberg, Legal Analysis by Jim Lazar. This is the people that we were talking about in regards to the spectro evidence blocked by the Nixon Justice Department. And here Weisberg is talking about Leon Jaworski and his role in the Kennedy assassination. And later on, he also mentions the Watergate affair. And he says, one of the Texas officials, the also respected and wealthy partner in a prestigious Houston law firm, Special Counsel Leon Jaworski, was Rankin's accomplice. And that's J. Lee Rankin, who is a...
J. Lee Rankin, you got it right.
Okay.
J. Lee Rankin.
All right. As shown by what I, meaning Weisberg, what I used to illustrate the transcript's reference to him, Jaworski was Nixon's second selectee as special Watergate prosecutor, as Dave mentioned, following the fired Archibald Cox. In that role, his record is not inconsistent with his working as the actual boss of the aborted Texas Court of Inquiry. Jaworski should never have accepted his Court of Inquiry post, as he should never have become special prosecutor, because he had a conflict of interest. He had been an active participant in illegal CIA activity, in secret funding of secret CIA fronts domestically. The first suggestion of Oswald as a federal agent, and it was almost immediate, gave Jaworski a conflict he could not resolve. With the abundant reporting of CIA involvement in the Watergate, he faced and ignored the same conflict. Jaworski was and remained on the M.D. Anderson Fund, publicly exposed as a CIA front in the 1967 CIA scandal centering around the National Student Association, which had been financed and seduced by the CIA. One of the abundant sources is a chapter of The Espionage Establishment, an expose of CIA by David Weiss in collaboration with Thomas Ross. So here's Leon Jaworski, who keeps cropping up and essentially is also, and it's important to note, not only show up, but he's been presented by the press to the people of America as the white knight of the American legal system, who comes rushing into these situations where there are, you know, possibilities of government complacence and wrongdoing, like Koreagate, like Watergate, like the Kennedy assassination, although that was being played down very heavily, but it was certainly an element from the very beginning. Leon Jaworski comes riding in on his white steed, the impartial and totally unblemishable patron saint of the legal establishment. Well, indeed, what we find out that all along, Leon Jaworski was fronting the MD Anderson Fund, a major CIA front and a group that was used domestically by the CIA to basically infiltrate and overthrow a whole bunch of student and activist organizations and things of that nature.
Two quick details in connection with that. Interestingly enough, Judge Sarah Hughes, who administered LBJ's oath of office, was the head of another one of these domestic CIA fronts. And now, Leon Jaworski was also named as Koreagate special prosecutor. One of the things that came out in the course of the Koreagate hearings was that Tongs and Park had set up the Moonies as a front for the Korean CIA, which is, of course, very closely affiliated with our CIA. It's interesting because the Moonies were very active on behalf of President Nixon during Watergate.
One of my own, and again, this is spoken in a rather cynical way, one of my own favorite parts of the Watergate-Kennedy assassination connections is the question, and now everybody out there who is alive and of reasonable age, even like 5 years old and older, knows where they were the day that John F. Kennedy was assassinated. I'm talking about six-year-olds in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm talking about, you know, nine-year-olds in East Weehawken, Michigan. I'm talking about everybody. Well, let's read a little segment here from Bernard Fensterwald and the Committee to Assassinate Investigations, Coincidence or Conspiracy, which we quoted from earlier tonight, and let's find out about somebody who doesn't seem to remember where he was when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Reading from Coincidence or Conspiracy. Richard Nixon, the defeated Republican presidential candidate of 1960, flew to Dallas on November 20th, 1963. Nixon was then working as an attorney for the Pepsi-Cola company and was in Dallas to attend a carbonated bottlers convention. Nixon remained in Dallas for 2 days, leaving the city about 3 hours before President Kennedy was shot to death on November 22nd. In an interview with political reporter Jules Whitcover in early 1967, Nixon told of his November 1963 trip to Dallas and his reaction to the Kennedy assassination. Quote, "I was in a taxi cab when I got the news." This is Richard Nixon speaking. "I was in a taxi cab when I got the news. I had been in Dallas attending a meeting. I flew back to New York the next morning. It must have happened just as my plane was landing. My cab was stopped for a light in Queens, and a guy ran over and said, 'Have you got a radio? The president's been wounded.' I thought, oh my God, it must have been one of the nuts. A half hour later, I got to my apartment, and the doorman told me he was dead. I called J. Edgar Hoover and asked him, 'What happened? Was it one of the nuts?' Hoover said, 'No, it was a communist.'" Going on. However, just 3 months after the assassination, Richard Nixon told the FBI another version of his trip to Dallas when he and his secretary, Rosemary Woods, were contacted by the FBI during the Warren investigation because Marina Oswald alleged that Lee had also thought about killing Nixon sometime in the spring of 1963. The Warren Commission was seeking to determine if Nixon had ever actually been in Texas during that period. During his FBI interview on February 28, 1964, Nixon inaccurately stated that he left Dallas on November 20th, rather than on November 22nd. An FBI report contained in the Warren Commission Exhibit 1973 states the following. On February 28, 1964, the Honorable Richard M. Nixon, former Vice President of the U.S., was contacted by Assistant Director in charge of the New York office, John F. Malone, and furnished, Richard Nixon, furnished the following information. Mr. Nixon advised that the only time he was in Dallas, Texas during 1963 was 2 days prior to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Okay, going on. That's an FBI document. While his early 1964 account of when he had left Dallas was obviously inaccurate, his interview with Jules Whitcover in 1967 was equally erroneous concerning his arrival in the city. Nixon told Whitcover, quote, "I had been in Dallas attending a meeting. I flew back to New York the next morning. It must have happened just as my plane was landing." Thus, while Nixon admitted in 1967 he had in fact been in Dallas a couple of hours before the shooting, he incorrectly told Whitcover that he had come to Dallas the day before the assassination, November 21st, rather than November 20th, the date he had actually arrived in the city. In his highly detailed account of what various public figures were doing on the day of JFK's assassination, William Manchester recorded in 1967 that Richard Nixon had departed Dallas on the morning of November 22nd on American Airlines Flight 82. While one hesitates to draw a conclusion of any kind from the episode, it does seem somewhat peculiar that Nixon managed to forget where he was on November 22, 1963, during his February of 1964 FBI interview. The often repeated cliche, quote, "No one will ever forget where they were and what they were doing the day President Kennedy was assassinated," seems to have been inaccurate in at least this one case. Efforts to review the Nixon episode were further hindered when the National Archives disclosed in 1976 that a, quote, "letter of FBI of June 29, 1964 concerning Richard Nixon" was one of the items missing from the Warren Commission records stored in the Archives building in Washington, D.C. The contents of the letter are unknown. Okay, we're going to let you think about Richard Nixon's strange inability to remember where he was.
It's worth noting, too, that there are about a half dozen different versions, three or four of which come from Nixon himself at various points in his career, of just what he was doing in Dallas and just when he left. It has been established that he was there as a lawyer for Pepsi-Cola Company. A former Pepsi official named Butler has testified that Nixon was at the Pepsi convention, and he was there, too, when the announcement of the assassination was made. So that apparently, according to this fellow Butler, a Pepsi-Cola official named Butler, Nixon was in the Pepsi convention when he heard the news.
Those excerpts, again, from The Guns of November, Part 3, recorded on November 15th of 1983. In addition to my own voice, you also heard the voice of Nip Tuck, my brilliant and very capable former co-host, whose assistance with the on-air responsibilities was fundamental to the execution of the archive shows. This concludes For the Record 961, Watergate and the JFK Assassination Part 1, being recorded on June 13th of the year 2017. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.